This is a wonderful place, and the scenery is just invigorating, and the crowd is fantastic, vibrant, etc. All that I typed in there.
But why do you have quotation marks around teach?
Oh, because I think it's more like a conversation. Okay, I may not be able to pull this off, so I'm just going to close it. The topic of the session today is why socialism. I'm going to this the mechanics that I propose for this conversation. I'm going to talk for a short period of time. I'm going to try to keep it self-contained, and then I will open the floor for your participation, comments, opinions, questions, etc. I grew up in an intellectual tradition that is secular, is non-religious. It's not against religion, but it's non-religious in the sense that it doesn't invoke the word of God to, for example, advocate or justify socialism. So it rather appeals or tries to appeal. In principle, that is the idea, to facts and to logic. So in those terms, I will proceed. I have to be honest to my own views, right? So I will try to present them directly to you. The question that I pose for this conversation is why socialism? Why is there a need for the proposals of an alternative society that people associated with the socialist movement have advocated for. Some of us, I think probably most of us, remember that in the late 1980s and when the Soviet Union collapsed, all of a sudden history ended. There was an author, Francis Fukuyama, who wrote a book who said that the collision between the two competing visions of society had been settled definitively, that socialism was dead and that capitalism was a trap. Long-lived capitalism, right? Free markets and the underlying social inequality on which capitalist markets exist, one way or another, we had just to accept it as a fact of life. There was not much to do about it. And it turned out that was too fast, right? This idea of the end of history. Regardless of what our views may be, for example, of the nature of the social and economic order in China, or in Vietnam, or Laos, etc., in those Asian countries, they stick to the story that they are building some version of socialism. China says that they are building socialism with Chinese characteristics. Go figure, right? But that's their story. In Europe, in many countries in Europe, the influence of socialism is very palpable. Through the political tradition of social democracy, there are institutions that were in those societies that were the result of the struggles of working people in Europe, and that have roots all the way back to the socialist movement that emerged in Europe in the mid-19th century. More recently in Latin America, you're probably aware of the changes in South America, in Venezuela at first. President Hugo Chavez has led a movement, and they are claiming that they are building socialism, the socialism of the 21st century, right? So they are trying to distance themselves from the experience of the Soviet Union. Like, they are saying, we are building something different from what the communists in the Soviet Union did. in Bolivia under President Evo Morales, in Ecuador under Rafael Correa. These changes, which happened through electoral processes, have broken the isolation that that Cuba had. Right, Cuba was the only country in this continent that broke apart from capitalism, or at least with that intention, in 1959. Right, after the Cubans overthrew. Fulgencio Batista. So I was saying, right, that shows, that goes to show, in my opinion, that socialism is more resilient than people thought it was, right? That people in the early 1990s thought that it was. There is a certain robustness about socialism that it has a Terminator-like quality, right? It kind of clings and comes back, right? And so I will tell you what I think about socialism. The broader and the broader way in which I can think of socialism is a response, organic and radical response to the social conditions that exist, right, to the status quo, right? Can call it capitalism or whatever term we use to describe it, right? But if the conditions that exist one way or another offend us, one way or another don't measure up to our best dreams about how we expect a human society to be. And it seems that our standards tend to go up and up and up. Even though perhaps our practice doesn't follow up, right? And sometimes, we don't necessarily manifest our discontent through actions. However, we don't seem to be satisfied with the society that exists. And socialism, of course, it is a body of ideas about the attributes, the characteristics of an alternative ideal society. But it is first and foremost, from my viewpoint, a response, right? And I say that it's organic. Philosophers in the 19th century use another term to refer to this, right? They call it necessary, right? By necessary, they meant that it wasn't an accident, right? That it followed necessarily from the conditions that existed. Right, so in that sense, I think of socialism, that it flows from the conditions that it is. Just that, phenomena such as, social inequality, poverty, the feeling that we have that our lives, our social lives, our collective, the creations of our collective action are out of control, that we don't exercise a full control over them. Right, that phenomenon, which, by the way, Marxist socialists use a term to describe, to denote that phenomenon. They call it alienation, right? They call it alienation. And alienation in the sense of something that we human beings create, that we human beings produce, right? We produce our society, we produce our social relations, our social structures, yet we don't have, or we don't exercise a full control over it. By the way, yesterday in the religious a service that we had, there was a reading, I don't remember if it was the first or the second reading, well, Romans 9:15, Romans something like that, 7:15, I forgot, right, but it said something like this, it said, for I don't do what I love, something like that, right? I do what I hate, right? Or what results? That was kind of my interpretation. I'm stretching it, right? I'm not trying to construe, religious scriptures in a particular way, right? To fit my speech here, but I'm just connecting it to that, right? It's that feeling of a vehicle that you have built that is not, you know, not being steered by you, that it just has its own will, right? Our social institutions, our social relations kind of take their own trajectory in spite of our efforts to steer it in a certain way, right? It's that kind of phenomenon. And Marxists call that the totality of that phenomenon, they call it social alienation, right? And they think of it as the result of the fragmentation of human beings, right? The fact that you know, that humans are divided rather than united, right? And so in that tradition, right, socialism is precisely the you know, the breaking up, the dissolution of that division, right? In other words, the unification of human beings, right? It's the idea of cooperating, right? Helping one another, right? In a direct manner, right? In a direct manner. Indeed, you know, when we trade in markets, we are helping one another, right? We are, you know, I'm scratching your back, you are scratching my back. I'm giving you this, you are giving me that, right? When we engage in a commercial transaction, when we go to a supermarket, that's precisely what we are doing. We are helping each other, and it is because we help each other that, you know, what we call the economy expands, right? Ultimately, it is the result of social cooperation. Economists call it gains from trade, right? Gains from trade, and they attribute that to specifically to market institutions, right? But if you think about it, actually, it's not really gains from trade. Of course, they are gains from trade because trade is cooperation, right? People are helping one another. But ultimately, the real reason why those gains in welfare exist, the reason why our welfare expands, is because we are helping one another, we are helping each other, right? What socialists believe is that, you know, there shouldn't be that mediation. You know, why should you help somebody not for the sake of helping somebody, not because you are really concerned about the needs of that human being. You don't look at that person as a real human being just like you, but instead, you look at that person as an instrument to your ends, right? You look at that person as a vehicle for you to attain your own ends, right? So it's a mediated way of helping. You have to help the other person so that the other person helps you, but you are not doing it for the sake of helping the other person, right? Although, you know, in real life, it's always a mixture, right? But I mean, in the pure market model, you are not supposed to, like Adam Smith said it, right? You know, it's not out of the goodness of the butcher or the baker that, you know, that we get bread and then we get meat, you know, in the supermarket. It's because they are self-interest, they are self-driven, and, you know, we are also self-driven. We just want the meat, we just want the bread, and we go to the supermarket, we give something in exchange for the meat and the bread, and then we get that thing. And yeah, it works, right? It works, but it's mediated, right? It's mediated, and socialists are unhappy about the phenomena that is associated with that mediation, because they think about that as an alienated social institution. Markets are as alienated phenomena. Because, you know, this is the way socialists think, if I am capable of interpreting how they think. Marx, for example, in his major work in Capital says, you know, that market phenomena, which is a product of how humans interact with one another, right? We create the market phenomena through our interactions, but those phenomena, for example, prices, they move, you know, up and down, like the prices for, you know, farm goods, right? The price of corn, the price of soybean, you know, they seem to follow a pattern that is like random almost, right? It doesn't seem to be, it doesn't appear to be controlled. It's definitely not controlled by the farmers. It's definitely not controlled by individual consumers, but it is the result of the actions that farmers and consumers, etc., undertake. And yet, you know, it appears as if when the price of corn or the price of soybeans falls, it appears, Marx says, as if the roof, you know, just fell over your head, right? It's like the low gravity. It appears as a natural phenomenon almost, right? It appears as if it were a work of God or a work of nature rather than what humans do. Okay, so that's about social alienation. Now, in response, I was saying that socialism is a response, is an organic and radical because it doesn't go after superficial phenomena, but it goes to the roots. It tries to uproot, tries to remove the sources of social alienation. That is the intention. Now, is this possible or not? That is an issue that is not resolved from my viewpoint. I don't think that the difficulties of building socialism have been resolved or can be resolved in theory, right? They cannot be resolved in theory. If they are ever going to be resolved, they have to be resolved in practice. It's going to be through trial and error. It's going to be through attempting different ways of getting around problems. And then some problems are going to be more urgent than others, and people are going to have to face them first, etc. So it is going to be more a practical resolution of those problems than the theory of how to solve those problems is going to be a byproduct of those attempts. So I will end this a little bit discombobulated presentation just by saying that that I find, for example, Holden Village to be one instance of this notion of just helping one another and cooperating. This notion of socialism as, you know, people helping one another. Holden Village seems to be like an example. It's a small example, but it seems like a successful example, robust enough to have endured a few decades already. Right, my wife, for example, has been coming here repeatedly over a period of at least 3 decades. So that's very telling, right? So I feel like instead of preaching or lecturing here about socialism, I should be more like observing how the managers of Holden Village, achieve this wonderful experience for us here. Because it's really remarkable that out of volunteer work, out of the goodness of the heart of people, this community has been built and has endured and has kind of spilled over its goodness around the world. So I'll stop there. Yes.
Define for me or for us the difference between socialism and communism, because I didn't think what the China and Russia had before during the Cold War as socialism. But I don't know if my definitions are correct.
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that quickly. It has to do with the history of socialism, and it's a complicated history. But I will say just quickly that in the early 19th century, some socialists that were discontent with the previous socialist doctrines, right? There were prior socialist doctrines that actually you can go back all the way to ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. Like you can read, Homer, right? And the description of the reforms under Solon, right? Even Pythagorean ideas, like all the way back there, you can find certain like Plato's Republic, right? Which, although it assumed the existence of slaves, etc., but it had a certain quality about, we humans have this quality, right? We are producers, we are workers. We don't just submit passively to the natural environment, right? We don't just accept what exists, what is given to us by nature or what is given to us by history. We transform it. We engage with it. We transform it, and as we do this, we end up transformed ourselves. That kind of notion. So that means that society, one way or another, if we can devise something like an iPod or a MacBook or whatever, right? These devices, right? That produce so much wonderment and enjoyment or whatever, or dread, whatever, to us, right? If we can manufacture something like this, then why should we think that human beings are going to be content with accepting, you know, a society that just spontaneously emerges out of, you know, without design? You know, why not people are going to try to instead design society? So these attempts go all the way back then, in 15th century England, in, you know, 18th century and 19th century France, etc. In the United States, in the 19th century, there was Robert Owen, I think. It was an experience. He tried to bring, you know, a certain model from England, you know, etc. There were several attempts. Now, in the mid 19th century, there was a group of people that were led by Karl Marx, German Jewish philosopher, lawyer, who said, "Well, the problem with these ideas is that they are not telling us how to go from here to there. They are telling us how the world should be, but they don't tell you how we can go from all the way there from here. And we have to, as his friend Friedrich Engels put it, we need to find the bricks with which we're going to build that society in the society of today, right? And we turn around the first impulse towards building socialism. We have to identify it in the resistance that people have to the social conditions. When people struggle against social conditions, regardless of how they do it, because they are going to do it with whatever political or ideological instruments are at hand. People are not going to necessarily, you know, they are going to use whatever is out there, right? If, for example, you know, like here, it's the Democratic Party or the Green Party or whatever, or no party, right? They're going to, whatever political formation is out there, they are going to use it, and they are going to try to use it to resist, you know, the social conditions, right? And to try to turn them around. And so Marx was very influential. You know, he was a very deep thinker and very influential, and his followers metastasized, right, in Europe. And their influence went all the way to Russia, and then Lenin, who later became the leader of the Soviet Union, right, the founder of the Soviet Union, was inspired by Marx. Now, in the Soviet Union, the conditions weren't precisely the ripest to build socialism, at least under the Marxist version, right, because Marx had the idea that in order to build this ideal society, it was necessary to have a high development of the productivity of, you know, of labor. You know, producers have to be highly productive, because you have to be highly productive because you have to have enough time to build a deliberate society, an intentional society. And so his approach, you know, his approach was the Soviet approach, right? Which, by the way, he didn't invent it. You know, it was the spontaneous organization that workers built in Russia in 1905, before the 1917 revolution. Anyways, and then, you know, many things happened in the Soviet Union that I'm pretty sure that Lenin would have felt betrayed by some of those things that happened, or Marx, right, or socialists in the 19th century. They wouldn't have recognized necessarily their ideas there. Now, Lenin, because of a dispute that he had with another branch of the socialist movement, he changed the name to communism, which was a name that also Marx used in the 19th century, the early mid-19th century. And Marx used that word communism because at first he was using socialism, but then there was a tradition in France that of people who were more like connected with workers, with working people, who weren't less interested in appealing to charity or compassion towards workers, but more like, you know, were trying to help workers organize their struggles. And because they called themselves communists, Marx took the name, and that's when he wrote that booklet, the Communist Manifesto. So Lenin took that name to distinguish itself from social democracy, because social democracy was one of the branches that followed Marx in Europe in the 19th century. So, and there have been socialists who have opposed the, you know, the way the Soviet Union manages affairs, and they retain the name socialism. In Europe, some socialists retain the name social democracy. So there are different varieties, different different terms to refer to that, and they have different approaches. But I find, to a certain extent, that discussion a little bit idle, because I don't think that that's really material to the experience of, for example, the United States. I think that if socialism were ever to be built in the United States, it would have to emerge out of, you know, 4th of July American, you know, American values, you know, where, for example, individual freedoms, individual liberties, individual rights are a very powerful tradition. So I don't envision, like, communism, like this Soviet or Chinese approach to communism, as being a particularly relevant, you know, concern for American socialists. And, you know, American socialists, yeah, they are a different, completely different phenomenon. Not that I know much about them. I don't know if I answered your concern. Yeah.
When you're thinking of socialism, are you, or not just you, but others, presupposing a particular form of government? I think our current political discussions, when people are blaming liberals being socialist or whatever, they're not really saying that. They don't like it. They want to have power in the hands of a few corporate leaders versus power in the hands of a few elected leaders. And I don't see that socialism necessarily presupposes a particular form of government.
I agree. I think it's something that each society, on the basis of its own history and its own traditions, and also on the compromises that people have to make with reality. I know of a Marxist, Leon Trotsky, you know, follower of Marx, that, you know, was one of the leaders of the revolution in Russia, and he was the founder of the Red Army in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia rather, and then he was kicked out by Stalin. And he said, or he wrote somewhere, that it wouldn't be a bad idea if American working people were to buy out, just like, you know, like slaves that used to buy, you know, their freedom, right? Or buy out their freedom. You know, like, okay, you know, I'll pay you. You know, how much do you want for my, you know, for the bond? And here it is. You just posted the bond, right? And you pay your enslaver, and then now you're free. Well, something like that. You just create like a beautiful island with, you know, beautiful housing, and send all the rich, you know, all the rich people that are in the way of building socialism, right? Those that are opposed, those that are, you know, that want to entrench themselves in the status quo, and they don't want to, you know, let go of their wealth, etc. Just, you know, put them there in a very nice area, a very nice island, send them to another place, and just, you know, send them good food and all that, and then build socialism, you know, something like that. So, yeah, no, but I mean, that's obviously a joke, right, or it's tongue in cheek, but what form of government? Definitely would have to be democracy. You know, perhaps democracy more in the classical tradition of democracy as, you know, power of the people, right? But how exactly, what would be the mechanism and all that, those issues are largely unresolved. Largely unresolved. Like, for example, I'm just going to tell you something about something about Cuba, where I live. I lived there for 5 years. I went to college there. And now there are some people saying, you know, oh, you know, Fidel Castro or Raul Castro is betraying socialism because now he wants to introduce markets, etc. And they instead, you know, they should allow for workers in the factories or in their, you know, productive units. They should own, you know, the they should manage them themselves. There should be a self-management of those enterprises by the workers, And I live there, and I, you know, every now and then I chat with my friends in Cuba, and when I pose that question to them, they say, like, what? We don't want to do that. You know, we spend so much time just, like, making ends meet, you know, finding food, finding kind of the basic necessities of life. Do we want to spend time arguing with our neighbors or arguing with our co-workers? No, 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 it's okay. You know, we don't want that. We want hierarchy in our enterprises. It doesn't matter. But isn't that dangerous? Yeah, it's dangerous, but it's more dangerous that I don't have time. You know, I don't have time to build democracy here in the workplace. You know, which would be like a socialist idea, right? Socialist idea would be, you know, well, the producers should control their life in their workplace, not only in society at large, but in their workplaces individually, right? How do you implement that in practice? You need time to do that. But, you know, that presupposes that we have a certain, degree of satisfaction of our basic needs, that our basic needs are met, so that we have time to do that. For that, we have to be sufficiently productive of those basic necessities so that we can allow time for this other thing. Yeah.
I live in Madison, Wisconsin, which some people would suggest is a large-scale experiment in this sort of thing. And I've been there since the early 70s, and it's really interesting to see small and larger institutions go through just the growing pains you described, wanting an idealistic, and it sounds like I'm making an insult when we say utopian or idealistic, we are sounding like we're condescending to the idea. But these are yearnings. We see something beautiful and we want to make it that way. Until we realize, as you said, how incredibly time-consuming it is. There was a grocery co-op that wanted to run by consensus, and it wanted to process every damn decision by consensus, and nothing got done, and it failed eventually after 30 years of trying to be this perfect democracy. My daughter, who's autistic, lives in a small co-housing community that's made up of people who are trying to make decisions about the lawn mowing and the everything by consensus. It's going to be very interesting. It's only 4 years old. And already they find out of 30 households that about 9 or 10 households are really into it, and the others are just not participating. They're voting not to use their time that way and to say, whatever you come up with, I accept, because otherwise I have to actually sit there through the meetings. So it's interesting how people begin to make decisions about efficiencies and making good compromises about, all right, I have a 24-hour day. I can live with something that wouldn't be how I would make it as long as I don't have to go through the process of making it. It's like an economic decision about my time, which is underneath money anyway, is the way I use my time, the way I sell my time, the way I employ my time.
I wonder if you can point to any example in history where a socialism type experiment has resulted in long-term prosperity across a wide swath of people. Has that ever happened?
Yeah, well, it's relative, but I would argue that there is an upside to the experience in the Soviet Union. And it's not only a local upside. I mean, obviously, you know, the rule of the Tsars wasn't tenable, you know, in 1917, or the rule of Kerensky, which was the Democrat who overthrew the Tsar immediately and, you know, replaced him. But his government, Kerensky's government, wasn't sustainable because they pursued the war, and, you know, the masses of Russia just didn't want to follow that. The Bolsheviks, Lenin's group, right, they promised that they were going to pull the plug on the war and that they were going to provide land for peasants. You see, this is not like, you know, it's not building communism. Lenin didn't promise to build communism. He just promised to face immediate, in very pragmatic way, right, immediate problems that the masses of Russia were facing. Number one, you know, the war, right? And number two, bread, right? We want to give, you know, people will have bread and land for the peasants, because the peasants have been duped. They were promised a reform, they were serfs, and, you know, the aristocracy under Alexander II, right, they, in 1867 or something like that, there was a reform which promised the freedom of the serfs, but actually just like shackled them with debt, etc. So people were very discontent, and they wanted, peasants were the majority of the Russian population by far. You know, industrial or urban working people were a small minority in just a few spots in the European area of the of Russia. So, but I mean,
upside, what, upside to Russia.
Yeah, I was going to refer to the upside, that those problems were solved. It took longer than Lenin thought, because there was a civil war, because the forces that wanted to defend the status quo, you know, rebuild themselves, and, you know, they wage a war, they cling to power, and it was a nasty war that was supported by even the United States under President Wilson. But after the Civil War ended, those problems were, or actually during and after, prior, during, and after the Civil War, the promises that the Bolsheviks made were delivered on. Land was distributed among the peasants. Stalin then undid a great deal of that, right? But that later on. But Lenin distributed land to the peasants. Right? The peasants pretty much took it over, and they individually held it, not collectively, but individually held it. There were a few cooperatives, and Lenin said, cooperatives are a good idea, peasants, think about it, you know, but take your time. There is no pressure. And then the war, of course, ended immediately at great expense to Russia. And then Lenin introduced reforms pretty much like what Cuba is trying to do now, markets, right? Lenin not only talked about markets, Lenin talked about private capitalism. He said private capitalism is our ally. You know, it's going to help us build socialism. Socialism is for later. But right now, private capitalism and state capitalism, and by state capitalism, what Lenin meant was something like this. It's like, okay, we own the land here collectively, yeah? But formally, legally, we own it. But can we manage it? Can we manage the forest? Can we manage these resources? Can we provide, like, you know, touristic services to people? No, we can't, because we don't have the talent, we don't have the resources. So how can we do that? We can rent that out to a private capitalist. We rent a piece of the forest to a private capitalist, and they pay us a rent that we'll use for, you know, social programs, what we now we call social programs, right? So all those very pragmatic measures, you know, Lenin, they call that the NEP, the NEP, the New Economic Policy. And Russia recovered very quickly. In the mid-1920s, Russia had already left behind the, you know, the output income levels of prior to the revolution Russia. So, but not only that, you know, there was much more than that, right? But mixed up with a lot of tragedy, of course, right? I mean, we are all aware of what happened, you know, the forced collectivization of the peasantry by Stalin, which was a tragic, massive mishap, or, you know, even that is an understatement, right? Yeah, some people will call it a crime, right? Because of the human cost, like, right? And other things that happened. But, you know, they were constrained, terribly constrained, you know? They were invaded by the Nazis, and they pretty much carried the burden of the war, World War II. I mean, according to the records, you know, over 20 million Russians or people of former Soviet Union perished under the Nazi occupation, etc. And they recover after the war. Under Stalin, they recover under, after the war, and they build an impressive scientific and educational establishment. Healthcare was relatively decent until, you know, later. You know, another war, the war, the invasion of Afghanistan probably did a lot of damage, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, et cetera. Yeah.
I've had a chance to live here in Barrow, Alaska, and Slovakia. And there is a certain beauty that everyone gets paid the same, whether they're a janitor or a physician. There is a certain beauty to that. But what I see is we all have a mixed system. You know, unemployment is not a capitalist idea. And you can just go on down the list. And the stuff that went on in Slovakia, there were a lot of things that were the same, but some people were more equal than other people. And so they had this, what they didn't do with money, they did with favors for each other and that sort of thing. So it's, I think any system that gets put together is going to be a mixed system.
Yeah, no, I've been to the Czech Republic in the border with Slovakia.
Yeah.
And which was the mining, you know, the Ostrava, that area. And and now, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and all that, that area is depressed, economically depressed. Prague is, you know, beautiful and shiny. But that area, I imagine Slovakia. The time when I was there, the Slovakian soccer team passed for, you know, the World Cup, so people were very happy because they defeated the Czech team or something. Yeah. But it, I mean, what I'm saying is, indeed, you know, the solution of certain problems, right, lead to the creation of new problems. Mm-hmm. But the hope, right, the hope, and I think that not only the hope, but the impulse, the drive that I believe is what socialism is really about, right, that drive to conform our social relations, our society, to our best dreams, to generalize the best achievements of human civilization, right? Not to have them just be the privilege of a few, but to extend them to everybody, or, you know, to have access to wealth for, etc. That is not gonna die. You know, there are gonna be obstacles in the way, and then by overcoming those obstacles, new obstacles are gonna rise. And we're gonna create new problems, and we're gonna have to face them in turn. And but I think that indomitable drive is what I call socialism, and I am pretty sure that it's going to reappear. Even if socialists, for example, even if in Hugo Chavez, you know, in Venezuela, right now there are some leftists in Venezuela who are very discontent with some of the things that actually there is now a little bit of a parenthesis because Chavez had cancer and he was treated in Cuba, etc. But before the disease, already some members of his following were criticizing him for certain things that he had done, and so it's all mixed.
I was wondering how you might characterize a country like Norway in terms of its experiment in social democracy or some of these principles, or I don't know if that.
I think that people here probably, I'm sure that people here know most of our, know more about Norway and the Scandinavian countries.
Because I don't know, I'm just curious, that's a contemporary version of it. Anybody knows, I don't know.
Does Norway hold North Sea oil as a sovereign wealth?
Yes, they have a sovereign wealth fund.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so they own their natural resources, the main natural resource, which is oil, right? They own it collectively, right? That is important, right? And then I think that they do contracts to private companies, etc., who exploit this or that, or do process it, etc.
But
they charge rent, and then those rents they go to a fund that is used for, you know, social development in Norway, and as a result, you know, that keeps taxes a little bit more comfortable, although the levels of taxation in Scandinavia would be outrageous in the United States. Would be like scandalous in the United States.
They do have health.
In New Jersey, that would lead to a very violent revolution. Yes.
They do have health care, though.
They do have public health care, that is. And
education, higher education.
Higher education. Now, one wonders, this is something that I read, not that I know, because I haven't visited those countries, but the Scandinavian countries have a degree of ethnic homogeneity, racial homogeneity, and that really helps. You know, the United States is a more complex society. Just demographically, we are more complicated. And when we are different, it's harder to cooperate. You know, it's harder to, because we don't know where people are coming from. Are they taking advantage of me or what? You know, and you need them to see eye to eye. And so that makes it more difficult. Now, when you compare, for example, the immigration policies of the United States to most European countries, the U.S. has more generous, more open, you know. I mean, I'm very critical of U.S. immigration policies, right? And in general, the attitude of many Americans about immigrants, right? But even though this is a nation of immigrants. Yeah. But, you know, I recognize that compared to European countries, compared to Spain, mm-hmm. right? For a Mexican Indian in New York, you know, we feel like, you know, respected.
Sure.
You know, for the most part respected, even in whatever the status, legal status may be, right? That person is going to feel respect because, you know, hardworking, and people appreciate hard work in New York. Mm-hmm. And that same person in Spain, I don't think that person would be equally comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the language would be
Or Italy.
Or Italy, or, yeah.
Germany or France.
Or Scandinavian countries also, I think. You know, and this is something the Europeans are now dealing with, these waves of immigrants from Africa, which has only compounded as a result of these revolutions in North Africa.
Well, but they've got immigration amongst themselves too.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Europeans going different places.
Absolutely, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Please. I'll
just announce that I'm a dedicated leftist who lived in a challenging place for a living, which is Cambodia.
Mm.
And I want to push you a little bit on some of what I see as a rather rigid adherence to Marxist dialectics in your position.
Okay.
You make claims, or have made claims that I'm hearing, that sometimes efficiency must come over issues of ideals or self-management. And these are the arguments in favor of production and dialectical production for efficiency, the need for leadership and social management. These are always, and historically have always been, the excuses that hierarchs give themselves and to each other to enact mass slaughter and exploitation. Capitalism seems to me to be clearly a system in which a very few profit at the expense of the service of the many. The United Soviet Socialist Republics ended up very much the same. There may have been great advances, but there were also approximately 100 million deaths. Cambodia lost one out of every seven. Communism is not a welcome word in Cambodia right now, despite the fact that people desperately want more equality. Now, if you ask them the facts, they sound very much like socialists. If you talk to them about communism, they'll spit in your face.
Mm.
I guess I am a little disturbed by an ongoing adherence among many international socialists to the sort of dialectical model that says, break a few eggs, introduce some hierarchy, these are necessary steps. In the histories I've looked at, hierarchs tend not to give up their power, no matter how well-meaning they go into their positions.
Mm.
And I just wanted to sort of raise that issue and offer it up to you and ask for a response.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, definitely there is a point to what you are saying. There is a chicken and egg problem, though, with this issue of hierarchies. I mean, just the fact that we see that hierarchies tend to replicate themselves, and that they can use as an excuse, you know, this discourse on efficiency, right? We have to do it this way because this is the efficient way to do it, right? That leads to the question of, okay, how do you get rid of hierarchies?
Right.
in a sustainable manner, right? Not just, you know, not just the destructive aspect of getting rid of them, but also the constructive aspect of getting rid of them. That means building an alternative to those hierarchies. That means building a horizontal society,
right?
That is sufficiently robust to withstand, you know, to withstand even the opposition of those who wanted the hierarchies and who may cling to them, right? So it has to satisfy all that. And the requirement has to be a movement from the bottom up.
Right.
So when there is a movement from the bottom up, right, that claims for the destruction of hierarchies, I think that a lot of socialists, at least from the tradition that I tend to associate myself with, Marxist traditions, right, would be sympathetic to that.
Yeah.
Right? We would be sympathetic to that. But you know, if there is a grassroots movement, right, that is discontent with those hierarchies and envision a more horizontal, right, social structure, right? Go ahead and try it. Right? And let's hope that it sticks. Right? Let's hope that it sticks, right? The issue of efficiency, I'm planning to discuss this in a further session, right? But
you can't have all the answers right now.
Yeah, right. But I will say something quickly about it, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can think of many arguments why socialism would be better in principle, in theory, right? Mm-hmm. Making it better in practice is a different animal, right? But why in theory socialism would be better than the status quo, right? And you can think of, you know, ideals of justice and fairness and equity, right? Equity as an argument. However, ultimately, that society has to stick. It has to be robust. It has to be sustainable. And that's why I think the principle of efficiency trumps the other ones.
Hmm. Now, so you're willing to go with the idea that efficiency should trump equality?
Yes, but there is another session where I'm going to be talking about what I mean by efficiency.
Okay.
What I mean by wealth. What I mean by goods.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily that good. You know, it's not necessarily that goods are more stuff.
Yeah.
You know, more computers, more. You know, I'm not saying that. What I mean by good is, for example, more. You know, friendship,
mm-hmm.
more human mutual support. That is. Actually, Marx wrote something like that. He said, our real wealth is the wealth of our social relations.
That's right.
Which I believe is completely true, right? Our real wealth. And you know, when you, like, Americans say it, but they say it differently, right? I mean, like my family, right? Why my family? Because that's where we have, you know, so much invested in terms of human relations, right? People don't say my work, you know? Don't say, you know, what do you really value? What is the thing that you value the most? You know, the moments that I spend with my family, you know, the moments that, things like that, right? So that's what I mean by good. That is what I mean by wealth. But, and the production of that, right, you know, is being efficient, being not wasteful in the production of that good is what I mean by efficiency. And I think that sort of efficiency does trump the, because it incorporates already. It's kind of tricky, right?
I wish those hierarchs had the same definition of efficiency that you did.
Yeah. Well, the thing, the this is the issue that the notion of efficiency, the notion of welfare in a society is an arena of
mm-hmm.
the social struggle. You know, people have to I think in the United States, to a certain degree of success, for example, environmentalists have managed to shift the notion of welfare. In the sense that, hey, we also have to produce a sustainable relationship with the environment. So that's a good that we need to produce. That's what wealth means to us. And that's, you know, and then capitalists are kind of trying to catch up with that, right? And say like, hey, look, you know, we are using recycle, etc.
I mean, is that not part of what the social contract defines then is how that efficiency is used. And that is, if the goal of Lenin or Stalin was to turn their vast tracts of natural resources into machines of war, iron, steel, goods that they could control and use in war, then then doing that efficiently was the benefit of communism. If our goal as a society is to build those social relationships, is to have that equality and justice throughout our people, and so that everybody has health care and everybody eats well and everybody has a place to sleep, then efficiency towards those ends as a function of our government and how that contract, how that social contract we call government, what its goals are, then efficiency is excellent. If the efficiency is excellent, right. If it's taking us towards those mutually agreeable social goals that which in this country were part of where we started. And but as we're seeing with what's going on with the labor unions now, whereas at one point the grassroots took some power and said we're going to form labor unions and we're not going to work for the robber barons, now we're seeing that turn back around. And some of those things that empowered the people to do that in the first place have been taken away from them. And so it's kind of like in your studies of the rise of socialist countries, socialist governments, was there a critical mass that a certain number of people who had to kind of agree on what that contract should look like before the grassroots actually had a chance to grow?
I'm not a historian, but in my reading of history, in most of the revolutions that led socialists to power, right, and attempts to build socialism, resulted from people being fed up with what existed. It wasn't necessarily that they have a very clear notion of, oh, we want to replace it with this. They were just like fed up. And it was a scene more like, you know, like it's like the theater is burning, right? Their flames are ready, and then people either like, you know, try to escape or they are gonna die inside, something like that. It was like really that kind of tragic dilemma that people faced. And it wasn't like really thinking a lot about what's coming up. It was more like, you know, socialist leader or, you know, leaders or, you know, groups, political groups that had gained experience and ascendancy among the people through their struggles, etc. In some cases, even like just by sheer luck, that they ended up leading those movements. But then in that process, then both the leadership and the people, and you know, under the hostility of, you know, the status quo, right? Like for example, in Cuba, right? I think that the U.S. hostility towards Cuba was a very important factor in, you know, in moving things in that direction. You know, it was kind of an unintended consequence, sure. Right? Mm-hmm. But I think that you know, Fidel Castro had, I mean, there were anecdotes in Cuba about, you know, like meetings early on, just after the triumph of the revolution, where somebody was giving a speech, you know, to a group of people there, and you know, with their beards and, you know, their fatigues, and saying, you know, and the Americans are accusing us of being communists, you know. Us accusing us of being communists. We have distributed the land among the peasants. How they call us communists? They are the ones that are killing people in Vietnam, etc. Like, you know, they had no idea what communism or socialism was, right? So they were just like dealing with the immediate. But what you just said, I think it is very important. About this notion of the social contract, right? Well, let me see. I think we are already past the time. So I think let's be disciplined and let's stop here. And,